You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, UW-Madison researchers are looking at how and why stress can affect asthma symptoms. One of those scientists joins us on the show. First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. Governor Walker announced a plan that would close the troubled Lincoln Hills Youth Prison and replace it with an adult detention center. A bill in the state capitol that gives landlords more power to evict tenants is getting criticism for the effect it could have on domestic abuse victims. And the Green Bay Packers are making big changes to the coaching staff and front office. Robert Mentzer is a statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau. He joins us each week at this time. And Rob, great to have you back.
Hey, it's great to be back. And Happy New Year.
And Happy New Year to you as well. Well, the big news this new year so far, Governor Walker's plan to repurpose the Lincoln Hills Youth Prison. This is something that's gotten some bipartisan support. Questions over the timing, though. This is not too far north of where you are. What's been reaction in your part of Wisconsin?
Right. Well, I mean, it's hard to say. It's all very new, and I think I'm not the first to point out that this is a proposal. Nothing in the governor's proposal would take effect until at least 2019. There's a lot of details that we don't yet know. But that said, to the extent that we've seen local reaction, it's been more positive than not. Our reporter Keith Ulig in Wausau just had an interview with, for instance, the chairman of the Lincoln County Board, who said that it seems like a good proposal and a good way of dealing with what we all know have been serious problems at Lincoln Hills. Lincoln Hills is a major employer in Lincoln County, at least as proposed by the governor, the idea would be to convert that into a medium security adult facility. So some jobs would remain there. Other positions would have the option of transferring elsewhere in the state. There's a lot of unknowns, but mostly positive reactions locally as far as we can tell.
What's been the reaction in your area and in Lincoln County with the ongoing scandal and concerns about what's been going on at the Lincoln Hills facility?
Well, so I think it's probably important to say right away that the most important thing is the treatment of the kids in the prison, the well-being of these youth, the efficacy of the programs in getting them the support and the training and the help that they need to take a different path in their lives. And I think people locally, certainly people who've been involved with Lincoln Hills or worked there or had, had connections to it, their pride in the place was in it as a rehabilitative institution. And in fact, a lot of these reports really strike at that image, the idea that the place was, was helping the kids who were sent there, and that's troubling, right? That is a disturbing fact to contemplate, that in many cases the practice of the institution fell much short of the purpose.
We'll keep talking about this plan to change things there over the next many months, I'm guessing. I want to move on to a bill in the legislature in the state assembly. It has to do with landlords and evictions. It's getting some criticism for the effect it could have on victims of domestic abuse. What's the concern there, Rob?
Well, so right now there's a law that allows a court to order that someone who's a victim of domestic violence and is on a waiting list for services cannot be evicted while they're awaiting this. And this kind of makes sense, right? If someone's a victim of domestic violence, the process of getting out of that situation can entail some financial hardship. Under this bill, that would no longer be an option. That victim would get 5 days and then could be evicted. The sponsor of the bill, who is a guy named Representative Rob Brooks of Saukville, said he's going to rewrite it to extend it to 10 days. But the point is, I think that victim advocates and, just when you sort of think about it, it feels a little bit wrong for someone who's a victim of domestic violence to be kicked out in the middle of that, especially if they're in the process of receiving the services that are available.
And that's one part of this bill sponsored by Representative Brooks. Another part would make changes to when local governments are allowed to inspect rental properties. What would happen to that under this bill?
Right. Well, just to step back.
Sure.
This is like a massive bill with a whole bunch of different provisions. There are historic preservation requirement changes, and basically the way to understand it is it's a pro landlord bill. Some would say it's an anti tenants' rights bill. So it's as you please. So what'll happen is there's a subpar property, and local governments see it as a problem property, and they have the ability now to check on it. And this bill would make that harder. There would need to be a formal complaint. They wouldn't be allowed to go in, and it would. So that helps the landlords. But the argument against is that it's going to cause these places to have problems, reduces the ability of the local government to do anything about it.
And this is part of an ongoing argument also over local control of governments, cities, for example, to set their own laws or regulations when it comes to something like housing. Is this something that you think will be a point of contention in the bill?
This bill comes after a series of changes. This has been something that the Wisconsin legislature has done a lot on in recent years, and moving always in the direction of the sort of pro-landlord direction. That is the tone and the mood that the legislature has been in. It may be that at this point for this piece of legislation, some of these may be reaching the point where there's going to be sufficient sort of political pushback that any number of these, certainly the domestic violence, some of the inspections provisions, may become a flashpoint in a way that previous law changes just never were politically.
Talking to Rob Metzer from the USA Today Network, Wisconsin, looking at some of the news around Wisconsin over the last week. A sad story, Rob. On Sunday, a small plane crashed in Costa Rica, killing all 12 people aboard. That included 33-year-old Amanda Geisler from Thorpe, Wisconsin, and of the UW Stout women's basketball team some years back. Can you talk about the reaction in the communities involved?
Yeah, this is a sad story. So Geisler had... She was 33. She had played basketball at UW Stout from 2003 to 2007, and she was pretty good. She played in a lot of games, and so a lot of folks knew her from that. And she had gone on to work for this this tour company that operated in Costa Rica and took people around to see the sites and fly over an active volcano and these sorts of things. And yeah, so she was actually the guide on this trip when the plane crashed in high winds on New Year's Day. She was one of the 12 people who were killed. So herself and two Costa Rican crew members and 10 U.S. citizens who were on the tour all died. So very, very sad.
And then finally, big changes in the Green Bay Packers organization. Not a great season. Of course, the injury to Aaron Rodgers, other problems as well. Didn't make the playoffs for the first time in a bunch of years. Who is in and out when it comes to the coaching staff for Green Bay?
Yeah, a bunch of axes fell this week. And this is, this has certainly been among our most popular, most read stories of the week as following Packers personnel changes. Only slightly less popular than following Aaron Rodgers' dating life, but we'll maybe get to that. So to answer the question, Dom Capers, the defensive coordinator, is out. The offensive coordinator, Edgar Bennett, also lost that position, though he's still with the team. And actually, there were several other coaches within the organization who all were fired this week. So it's a shakeup.
And, you know, I have some friends on social media who are very quick when things aren't going well to call for people to be fired. People have been talking about, I think, Dom Capers in particular for some time now. But on the other hand, there have been a lot of injuries. It's hard to blame a coach for that. Is there a sense from the team that, okay, in general, we just needed a new direction here?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, this was a – so I'm not an expert in this. I don't know. Everybody has an opinion, and I wish them the best. But, you know, this is the first time in 8 years that the Packers didn't make the playoffs, and that is an impressive run for the team. But it's also a relative loss of status this year. And that I think it's almost that that whiplash that that fans really react to, and that is when you do this kind of coaching shakeup.
Rob, we're not going to shake things up with you. We hope we'll have you back next week. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Robert Mentzer, statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau. He joins us pretty much every week to recap some of the top stories in state news. Researchers at UW-Madison are looking at how stress can affect the symptoms of asthma. It's part of a four-year, $2.5 million study looking at how exactly the mind and body communicate in stressful situations for people with asthma. And the goal is to find ways to change that communication to improve treatment. Dr. William Bussey is a lead researcher for that study. He's a professor of medicine in the Division of Asthma, Pulmonary, and Critical Care Medicine at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Bussey, thanks for joining us today.
Glad to.
Well, first, let's talk about the relationship between disease and stress. How do they interact with each other?
Well, there's been a longstanding interest in the role that stress plays in any disease, and particularly in asthma. And a number of years ago, the focus was primarily on the possibility that stress was making asthma worse, and people were directing treatment towards reducing stress. We've reevaluated this relationship, and what it seems to indicate at the present time, and these are our thoughts as well, that stress is no doubt generated to a large part by events that are occurring as a consequence of asthma. And we've done some studies which have shown that in a modeling system, that if you provoke asthma, areas of the brain become activated in relationship to the severity of the asthma event. So what we're interested in determining now is how asthma can affect stress or stress-related events, and try to understand how the brain is working in bringing this information together and possibly trying to better regulate things that are making asthma more severe.
So if I'm hearing you right, it could be a vicious circle. If I have asthma, if I have an asthma attack, that's obviously stressful, so I feel the stress. That, in turn, could make my asthma worse.
The vicious cycle analogy is absolutely perfect, and this is exactly what goes on. And I think what has happened is we're changing our focus rather than saying it's the stress that is making it. But, again, can we try to better understand how the lung communicates with the brain and brings about these stressful related events? If you can't breathe, that's stressful.
And I wouldn't have necessarily thought of it that way. There's the brain. I think of asthma as a condition of the lungs. So, but obviously, if stress and asthma are interacting, there's a connection. There's a physical link. How do you start to try to tease that out?
Well, you're absolutely right. But again, if you think about things in general, the brain has to be involved in any situation. It's something that allows us to interpret symptoms. Asthma is a disease of the lung, or more specifically, a disease of the bronchial tubes. So the way we're trying to dissect this out is the following. We're trying to provoke, you know, asthma events by, you know, laboratory modeling systems, and look at the messages or signals that come from the lung to the brain. And we can do this by doing, you know, MRI studies of the brain when they're having these events. And by looking at the products that are generated in the lung, the cells that are activated, we can try to dissect out more specifically how the brain is activating the lung. The other aspect of it, which is far more difficult, is to try to understand how the brain can influence the lung. And the way we're doing that is actually to put people under stressful conditions, then provoke, an asthma event in the laboratory. And by provoking these events through two different systems, we can get an idea by looking at the changes in asthma and also by imaging of the brain to find out which regions are activated in relationship to these events. Our thoughts are that the brain is acting to try to retain or maintain what we call homeostasis, or returning to a normal controlled situation. If we can understand that, I think it adds some additional information about what influences the severity of asthma and possibly how to control this.
And we have the technology now to look at what the brain is doing during this asthma attack, the feedback that's going on between the lung and the brain?
We think we do. We think we do. And again, we're using the MRI scans and also PET scans, which allow us to really get ideas of both brain activation, but more importantly, areas of the brain that are activated in relationship to these asthma events.
And then long-term, are you hoping that we can figure out treatments to at least minimize the feedback loop here?
Absolutely. And again, first of all, is to find out what are the molecules that are doing this. And again, if you find out the molecules, you might be able to develop, blockers of these. I think the other aspect, which is very intriguing, is the possibility that you can go through other non-medication-related approaches, such as mindfulness, meditation, or something such as that, which is known to modify, these circuits in the brain. And if you can do that, you might be able to have a consequential effect on events that are occurring into the lung. And again, ways to test this certainly are under development and have been looked at in other disease states.
We're talking to Dr. William Bussey from the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. We're looking at asthma and the brain. So, Dr. Bussey, I know maybe I'm getting way ahead of things here, but could we see a day where part of the treatment for asthma is something like a cognitive behavioral therapy, a coaching technique for a mental response to asthma?
I think that's a very real possibility, and the reason that we're able to do this is because on campus we have a very strong neuroscience group in psychology, Dr. Richard Davidson, who has expertise in this area, and our group has expertise in asthma. And bringing these two things together, I think this is certainly one of our goals, and hopefully this is not so far out in the future.
You've been researching asthma for a long time. Are you excited by these possibilities?
I am very excited because, first of all, it's a new frontier. I have spent most of my time looking at events in the lung. And going outside the lung to the brain, I think, just brings us into a new area of both research and understanding, and with the potential of some very novel ways to approach treatment.
It seems to me that this particular research is about asthma. It doesn't sound like this is necessarily just about asthma. We could see similar things for other conditions.
Again, that certainly is a real possibility. The advantage, from my perspective, with asthma is we can study this quite well in the laboratory. There's ways in which we can bring about these events very acutely in the lung and safely. Whereas with some of the other disease, like rheumatoid arthritis or inflammatory bowel disease, it's a little more difficult to do that. But the modeling of the system, I think, is right on target. We also know that there's a lot of commonalities between some of these chronic diseases as far as the immune system is concerned. So if we, from our studies in asthma, can find out what are the cells, what are the pathways, one can then have some guidance to go into other diseases and to find out if the processes are very, very similar.
This it does seem exciting because there's been this, I think, kind of vague notion for a while that, our mental state, our mind affects our health, our well-being. We're finally starting to connect the dots, though, it sounds like.
I think the technology allows us to connect the dots, and I think that that's very important. But I think it's also trying to bring these two systems together, because many times years ago, people felt that, stress was, sort of the causative aspects of many components of asthma. And if you could reduce stress, asthma would not be a problem. And the focus was on the stressful aspects, whereas those of us who were dealing in the lung really felt that, you know, that may not be the situation, and we're really addressing, you know, the inflammatory events in the lung. But that's not the way we work. We work with the brain, we work with lungs, and the two are working together. And being able to bring these two systems together, I think, will, you know, open up some avenues of study and information that, when you think about it, is exactly what's happening in human disease.
I know there's still this research to be done, but talking to your patients, talking to people with asthma out there, are there ideas, are there lessons they can start working with already in their lives?
I think it's, at the present time, that may be a little premature. But I do think that, you know, understanding, you know, these connections becomes very, very important, because sometimes, you know, years ago, patients used to feel, you know, uncomfortable and sort of feel that they had, because of their anxiety, brought on components of their disease. And I think now we understand that that's not the situation at all. It's the disease that is amplifying some of these psychological stress, depression-related activities. And I think that that's very reassuring, you know, to them and to us as caregivers.
You know, it's interesting, because I think for a lot of people with a variety of conditions, they may hear a message like, there's a mental component, there's a stress component, there's an anxiety component, as, you're telling me my condition is all in my head. But that's not really what's going on.
Well, it is all in your head, but in a different way than what we thought about before. You know, we can now find the neural pathways that are involved in these processes. And I think sort of saying it was all in your head was what was said many times. And I think that that was not doing all of us, a favor.
We'll leave it there for now. Dr. Bussey, thank you so much for sharing this research with us.
No problem. Take care. Bye-bye.
Dr. William Bussey is a professor of medicine in the Division of Asthma, Pulmonary, and Critical Care Medicine at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. He joined us to talk about the relationship between stress and asthma. Now, you may have heard by now that 2018 is an election year. Across the country, voters will head to the polls in November, and control of Congress will be at stake. Wisconsin is a part of that story. Democratic Senator Tammy Baldwin will defend her seat against a Republican challenger, TBD. But that may not even be the biggest election the state will see this year. Governor Walker is up for re-election, and a growing group of Democrats are lining up wanting to challenge him, leading to a crowded primary election in August. Also, State Attorney General Brad Schimel is up for re-election, though fewer Democrats appear interested in that race. And Congressman and House Speaker Paul Ryan will face a challenge from within his own party if he runs again. Lily Gorin is a professor of political science and global studies at Carroll University in Waukesha. Lily, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on this warm, sunny day in Wisconsin.
Well, yeah, I mean, thinking about an August primary, it at least makes us think about heat.
That's true.
And the race is heating up, Lily. Okay, I'm sorry. But there's a lot going on in this race. Let's start with the race for governor. Democrats, lots of them lining up to run here against Governor Walker.
Yeah, I mean, the list is long and continues to get longer. We had another entrant, recently this week as well, the mayor of Madison, over the last couple of weeks. And there still are maybe one or two more people who are thinking about getting into this race on the Democratic side. So you do see a lot of action, a lot of activity for the Democratic nomination to run against Scott Walker.
Yeah, here's some of the names here. Tony Evers, State Superintendent of Public Instruction, former State Democratic Party Chair Matt Flynn, Milwaukee businessman Andy Gronick, activist Mike McCabe, firefighter union head Malin Mitchell, Alma State Senator Kathleen Vineout, Eau Claire State Representative Dana Wachs, former Madison State Representative Kelda Royce expected to run as well, maybe others. So this, as a political scientist, you've got to be interested in this because, you know, somebody could end up winning a primary with like 13% of the vote.
It's possible. I mean, part of it is all these people have indicated, have signed up for, you know, a line on the ballot, basically. But the question is, will they all make it to the primary as well? Will they have funding? Will people know who they are? Will they have the capacity to advertise? And you know, now is when you're going to start seeing people doing some retail politicking, starting to make their way around the state, getting their name out there. So while there are lots of people who are currently in the race for the nomination, I have a feeling it may whittle down a little bit as we move through the spring and into the summer.
We've seen some Democrats lately saying, whatever we do, don't run a Madison liberal. And now the big news lately is Madison Mayor Paul Soglin, longtime activist, on and off mayor, definitely in the liberal side of the Democratic Party, already being attacked by Governor Walker as extreme on the left. Is that something the Democrats should be considering?
Well, I mean, I think that at this point you have a lot of people who have entered the race, and if Walker is paying attention to Soglin, it may be because he has had interactions with him, also as the mayor in Madison, where the state house is. But you know, there's been a little bit more action, at least that I've seen, with regard to Andy Gronick and Tony Evers, among others. And so Soglin's a little bit of a late entry at this point.
It's still a long way off till the primary. I want to talk about overall trends in this race, not just for governor, the whole shebang, legislature, whatever. And I want to present to you, Lily, the best case scenario for each party and ask you to tear it apart a little bit.
Okay.
So let's start with the Democrats. This is what you're hoping for if you're a Democrat out there. It's a wave year. You've got an unpopular, a low-rated Republican president out there. Usually when you've got a president of one party, the other party does really well in those off-year elections. That's going to add up to big wins for Democrats in these statewide races and maybe in the state legislature. What's wrong with that?
Well, I mean, there is the issue of the wave, and we have yet to see it sort of as an actual wave. We've seen a couple demonstrations of the potential in places like Alabama and the Virginia governor's race also, and the Virginia state house races. But sort of the difficulty also is, particularly in a state like Wisconsin, is the disconnection between the federal level politics, the president, the United States Congress, and in this case, the Senate is more connected to that, and what goes on in the state, where you have governors who are running the state and the state legislature and the assembly running the state. And so those two things can be disconnected from one another, even during a wave election. And so what goes on in a state can sometimes be a lot different than what's going on sort of in national level politics.
All right. Now, the Republican best case, the 2016 presidential election proved Wisconsin is not as purple as it used to be. A Republican won the state in the presidential race for the first time in a long time. The economy doing pretty well nationwide. That could make people favor the incumbent party. Republicans have a better ground game. The Democratic Party itself, more of a hypothetical entity, and the unions that used to do a lot of their ground game, they're not as powerful anymore. So what's wrong with that hope from the Republican side?
And again, you know, sort of some of the same dynamics are at work. If it's again a wave election, then the sort of disconnection that the state has from the federal level sort of experiences. So if Trump's approval ratings are low, that may not have an impact on whether or not it's a sort of a Republican sort of stronghold in Wisconsin. And the other thing to consider in context of this election cycle in Wisconsin is Scott Walker is running for a third term. He's got a long record that he's running on. And so if one of these many Democrats, whoever is the nominee, can sort of run against a governor who they can also sort of point to a variety of things that he has done, and try to connect that to, in fact, also national politics.
Talking to Lily Gorin from Carroll University, looking at election 2018 here in Wisconsin. Lily, what do you see as some of those issues that are likely to come up in the race for governor?
Well, I mean, I do think that the Foxconn deal and the sort of the short-term and long-term effects of that may be part of what is discussed. Higher education in Wisconsin since Scott Walker took office has been a very controversial area, and education in general, which again is a lot of where our state budget dollars go. Questions of transportation funding and what is and isn't being completed in terms of construction and funding may also be part of what Democrats may run on. At the same time, may also be part of what Walker will be running on. He's going to run on the success of the Foxconn deal. He's going to run on the changes he's made in higher education in Wisconsin.
I want to turn to the Senate race now. This is the other big high-profile one. This one's going to get national attention, I imagine, because Democrats, they just got one vote closer to taking back the Senate with Doug Jones from Alabama. Republicans will want to flip this. So we've got incumbent Senator Tammy Baldwin. Is this going to be on the national stage?
Well, I think that most of the Senate races are probably going to be fairly nationalized this year because the Senate is split so closely that both parties are going to argue that, you know, this Senate seat, either holding it or getting it from to the other side, can make it the difference. And so for Tammy Baldwin, it's a question of holding her seat. And for the Republican, be it Kevin Nicholson or Leah Vukmir or somebody else, it's a question of, you know, making the argument that this can help lead to a stronger Republican majority or holding the Republican majority in the Senate. So I think it will probably get a lot of national attention.
Now, those candidates you mentioned, Leah Vukmir and Kevin Nicholson, Vukmir, a state senator, Kevin Nicholson, a businessman in the Delafield area. It's been contentious. They've both signed a unity pledge saying, yeah, we'll support the other one if I lose. But it's been a little chippy, and with the Steve Bannon Donald Trump story, Steve Bannon's group had endorsed Nicholson. Now Leah Vukmir is saying, "Hey, Bannon's betraying President Trump. You've got to renounce that that endorsement."
Yeah, that's going to be sort of a complication because this is what also Bannon promised to do before the Alabama Senate race was, you know, sort of go through and get 15 of, quote, his people elected in the Senate so as to potentially get rid of Mitch McConnell. And so you have this, I mean, this week we've seen with this new book, The Fire and the Fury by Michael Wolff, come out, the kind of fighting between Bannon and Trump and the Bannon wing and Trump White House and Breitbart. And so they're not on the same page at this point. It could possibly change. Obviously, Trump and Bannon and so forth can all get back together and support Senate candidates together. But right now, it's not clear.
We're talking to political scientist Lily Gorin about the upcoming big elections here in Wisconsin this year, including races for governor, senator, attorney general, and more. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What election is on your radar in the coming year? Which candidates will have your support and why? What are you watching for politically in the coming year? Do you have your mind on those statewide races, governor and senator? Are you watching the local races in your community? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. We're continuing our conversation now with Lily Gorin, professor of political science and global studies at Carroll University in Waukesha. We're talking about the big elections taking place this year in Wisconsin and what to watch for in the coming months. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What race in Wisconsin has your attention in 2018? Or is it too soon? You're not ready to think about another election cycle. Give you a couple months. What do you think is going to drive people to the polls in November? What are the big issues for state elections, for the national elections, for Senate? What questions do you have? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Lily, I want to turn to the race for attorney general now. Not a crowded field here. We've got incumbent Republican Brad Schimmel. He has just one Democratic challenger in this race, Democrat Josh Call. Is all the air going to be out of the room for this one, since we're going to focus on governor and senator?
Well, I mean, I have a feeling that the concentration will definitely be more on the governor's race and the Senate seat race, and possibly, I think we may talk about this as well, the first district where Paul Ryan is. But, you know, attorney general's races are not necessarily, sort of spellbinding attraction that some other seats are. But this one, again, Schimmel is in his first term, and so he's still new to the job. And Call is young. I mean, that's one of the sort of critiques that Schimmel has raised against him.
Younger and less experienced, yeah. Schimmel says. And what kind of issues do we expect to see here? I mean, honestly, I think a lot of times in attorney general races, we see a focus on a few particular things that are just a small fraction of the actual job of the attorney general take over the campaign.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's probably where you'll see some of the conversation with regard to some of the lawsuits that the state has pursued, or that are possibly brought against the state. You have the Supreme Court case with regard to the gerrymandering issue. But, you know, again, it's not necessarily going to be the top of the ticket race that people are paying the most attention to. But if it is, quote, a wave election, and that has direct impact on the states themselves, then some of these lower ballot races, like attorney general or in other states as well, may be ones that sort of get caught up in that wave sort of dynamic.
Let's go to our callers now. We've got Jason on the line in Janesville. Jason, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What'd you want to bring up, Jason?
Oh, well, I just had a comment question. When it comes to state, you know, elections and local elections, I feel that people wait almost too late to pay attention, and especially when it comes to local elections. I, for one, reside in we have local elections coming up on April 3rd. People don't seem to pay attention until it's too late, and then the last minute, and then there's a whole lot of complaining going on. And I guess my question was, what is too soon and what is not?
Jason, thanks for the call. Lily, I mean, in the media and in political science, we pay attention really early with elections. But do you think there's something to what Jason says about people waiting too long to start paying attention?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of different stuff that political scientists have studied with regard to this. And the fact that we in the United States, we vote for a lot of offices fairly frequently. So we actually have, you know, requests to go vote, or we have the opportunity to go vote usually multiple times a year. So it's not like we just vote every 4 years for president or every 2 years for our House member. But we have, as Jason pointed out, we have elections coming up in April. And then we're going to have another election in August. And then we're going to have another election in November. And so And there may be a couple more in between there sometimes. And so what happens is that if you pay attention to the news, you hear a lot about national elections, which are the ones that usually happen in November, and they sometimes have the lead up in a primary. But we do always often have, you know, sort of local elections, city council, and so forth, that transpire not at the same time. And so as a voter, as a citizen, oftentimes we don't exactly know. I'm like, oh, I have to go vote today, or I have to go vote, you know, before that election because I'm going to be out of town in April. It's around Easter and so forth. And so that there, Jason raises a really good issue, an important issue, in terms of it's not necessarily paying attention too late or not paying enough attention. It's the fact that there are lots of different elections that we pay attention to differently. And sometimes that information can also be hard to sort of glean.
Thanks a lot for the call, Jason. We're talking about elections 2018 with Lily Gorin from Carroll University in Waukesha. Back to your calls now. Nate is with us in Sauk City. Nate, hi.
Thank you. I'd like to ask the professor why... what she thinks of the fact that The Democrats, the last three times, have nominated candidates from Milwaukee or Madison. They've failed in all three of those successive elections. Why they would see a successful prospect in running a candidate from there rather than someone like a Kathleen Fineout from the rural part of the state, I'd like her thoughts on that.
Nate, thanks for the call. What do you think, Lily?
Well, I mean, I think Nate also raises an interesting point with regard to Democratic strategy, is that the strongest Democratic strongholds in Wisconsin are, in fact, in Milwaukee County and in Dane County. And so a lot of times that's also where you've generated candidates from. In recent years, in recent election cycles. But what we see from this very broad sort of range of options is that Democrats may have quite a few different candidates from whom to choose in the primary. That doesn't mean that the candidate who gets the nod from the Democratic Party may not, in fact, come from either Madison or Milwaukee, but that there are a variety of candidates who are running from rural and urban areas in Wisconsin this time around.
Nate, thanks for that call. We'll go next to Ashley with us in Wausau. Ashley, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, Ashley?
So I actually wanted to draw attention to more of a local race. I'm in Wausau. And actually here in Marathon County, our County Board of Supervisors, there's 38 current members, and we have 15 women that are on the ballot this year. And actually a handful of them are under 40, myself included. And you know, I'm just wondering if this is kind of a trend you've been seeing, you know, in more local races. I've been reading that, you know, women are kind of starting to come out and run for office more and get more involved in that way. And I'm
Ashley,
wondering if that's...
Thanks for that call, Lily. Is this a trend, younger women running for office this year?
Women running for office this year. Younger as well as older, as well as in between. There's been, if you want to talk about waves, this may be an interesting one to follow. There's been a huge number increase of women running for offices on all levels. And so that is something that it will be interesting to sort of follow as you know, people go through primaries, but also on election night to see if there's an aggregate increase in the number of women in elected offices in the United States.
Ashley, thanks for that call. Before we run out of time, Lily, I do want to talk about Wisconsin's first congressional district, Paul Ryan, Speaker of the House there. He has a primary challenger, Paul Nealon, who didn't do very well against Ryan last time. Breitbart has dropped its support for him now. But is Paul Ryan running has been the big question out there.
I'm assuming Paul Ryan is running. I know I've heard the rumors. I've even commented on them. But at this point, I assume he's running. And he himself hasn't really indicated that he's not. Obviously, it's up to him, and it's a decision I assume he would make, you know, in consult with his family and with the Republican leadership and you know, reading probably internal polls as well. But I at this point, I assume he's running.
And if he runs, he's probably not going to lose a primary challenge.
I don't think so. And Nealon really got dropped like a hot potato recently by Breitbart and the Bannon folks. So I don't know that he has a serious challenge from Nealon. I don't know if there's anybody else who's going to step up and take on Ryan in the primary. Of course, he's got a couple of Democratic candidates who are angling to run against him. And so he may have more of a challenge also in the general election.
Lily, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
That's Lily Gorin, professor of political science and global studies at Carroll University in Waukesha. She joined us to talk about the big elections here in Wisconsin in the coming year. You'll have lots of chances to weigh in on those over the next few months, I imagine. Coming up on Monday on Central Time, Gemma Tarlak is back with us for a look at some interesting new discoveries and what they tell us about when humans arrived on the North American continent and who they were. And in the wake of a controversial video posted recently by a popular YouTuber, we'll look at the lines of decency and appropriateness and gatekeeping on the internet. That and more Monday on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer-Kent. Monday after 6, technology companies like Facebook target ads to specific age groups. Kate and her guests look at how legal loopholes allow employers to get away with age discrimination and also take a look at age discrimination more broadly. Coming up next, it's the news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then Governor Walker announced a plan to close controversial juvenile detention centers in northern Wisconsin. We'll learn what the future could hold for Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.